Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Michael Zuber had worked in the Silicon Valley since graduating from Santa Clara University 20 years ago. After wasting time and money in his 20s, he found real estate investing and more specifically buy and hold rental properties and never looked back. Michael focused on his day job, learned his market, and grew his rental property portfolio from a single rental house to financial freedom in 15 years. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, buddy. It gives me goosebumps every time somebody reads that.
That's amazing. I mean, you should be proud of that, you know, what you've done. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. Can you briefly tell us where'd you start, where are you now, and how did you get there?
Absolutely. So again, obviously, Michael Zuber, I've lived in the Silicon Valley my entire life. I've lived within about a 10 or 12 mile radius of the house I grew up in. And what that means is I've seen the Silicon Valley change. And it's gone from being orchards, like I lived right by a cherry orchard where we would take cherries off the tree and throw them at each other, just have some fun as kids, to now a place where these, you know, houses used to be 17, 18 grand, now are $1.4, $1.5 million. So it's crazy, crazy unaffordable. And as somebody who gets introduced to real estate, I spent a year, Sam, looking in the Bay Area for the magic cash flow street, because everybody says, Sam, invest 30 minutes from home, right?
Right, sure.
At least it didn't work for me. Ultimately, I had to make a choice between out-of-state investing or driving. I chose to drive. I found a market, Fresno, California, where I buy our first house in 2002, and we never left. That portfolio has grown to ultimately produce financial freedom. And I haven't had a day job for almost 5 years now, so it's pretty cool.
That's fantastic. I mean, you know, one of the things that we hear a lot on this show is that single family is not scalable. And you're here to prove otherwise. Walk us through that.
Yeah. So it's funny. I'm definitely a real estate investor. I've bought everything from single family homes to 20 units. So that's the biggest thing I bought. It's all I ever talk about. So again, by December 11th of 2002, I get asked about it all the time. It's 107 grand running for 1100, the magic 1% rule. And we end up buying eight of those from 2002 to about 2005 or six. But then, Sam, I'm looking for the ninth one. And remember, I start pre-crash. So the ninth one, we're looking and going, what the hell, right? There's nothing that cash flows. The only way they cash flow is if you get these stupid loan products, neg am, pick a payment, you know, all of those. And I'm like, you know, my accounting brain won't let me buy one of those. So we go to a real estate meetup and somebody introduced us to small multifamilies. So the first real big jump in our wealth and cash flows actually out of housing into multifamily. So we survive and frankly thrive in the crash because we don't have houses. We now have 80 units in apartments. We go from 8 to 80. And, you know, the world's on fire. That first house, we 1031'd at 264, retrades at 75. You know, it's a bloodbath in the market I am. But it's a bloodbath in single family, not multifamily. Because the thing that nobody reminds you of is rents went up. Rents go up in the last crash. So we're doing just fine. Now we're in a market, 2009-10, where houses, you know, that we had paid 150, 160K on the run-up are trading sub 60. We're like, huh. And oh, by the way, rents are up 30%. We're like, this is probably pretty cool. So we spend the next several years, hard money, private money, borrowing 401Ks, getting loans on cars, doing everything we can to buy as many single family homes as we can. And I think we cap out at like 44 or 46, you know, single families. Because they were just on sale. They were like picking up gold bars on the ground. It's like, do we want that one or do we want that one? And everybody was scared of single family. We would do everything we could to buy. And then obviously Wall Street steps in and the market turns and it goes from there. But yeah, it was, we love single family. Our portfolio today is probably 60-40 single family versus multi. And if I had a magic wand and I only could buy one thing for the next 2 years, it'd probably be single family, at least in my market. Every market's different. But we got really low cap rates. We got C-class trading like it's A-class. And I don't want variable rate debt. One of the things that makes residential super sexy today is I believe, Sam, we have artificially low 30-year money. And when I can lock it in for 30 years in an inflationary environment, I sleep at night. I would not want a 3 or 5 year ARM that adjusts later when cap rates have to adjust because of that. That makes the refi interesting, to say the least.
Right. Yeah, that's a valid point. And we're seeing a lot of that on the commercial side of things.
I have some. I've spent the last year and a half working with non-QM lenders to get all of my apartments on 30-year fixed rate. That's what I've been doing the last 18 months.
Right, right. And that's smart, because that is the side of things in 2008 that, you know, hamstrung a lot of people, was the leverage they had against their properties, or the type of leverage they had against.
Yeah. Well, people don't really realize it. Housing wasn't the problem. It was the lending product, the collateral, right? The lending product that blew up. You know, how many people had interest only loans for the, what was the 2 and 28s, right? 2 years interest only, 28 fully amortized, or even worse, the pickup payments. Those products blew up and that caused people to sell. And then that brought other people with strategic defaults to sell. And it was just, it was ugly for 4 years.
For sure. And it's amazing, you know, talking investor psychology here a little bit, that you were able to see the time to buy.
Yeah. And I wish I could tell you I got the bottom. I don't pick bottoms. I've looked at my market every day for 20 years, Sam. So I bought on the way down. We bought houses at 100 and then 80 and then 60. And we bought a whole bunch between 60 and 40. And then we bought it 60 and then we bought it 80 on the way back up, right? It was always secure capital next deal, secure capital next deal.
Right, right. And that's, you're getting the dollar cost averaging there across your portfolio. And that's crazy. I mean, to think that you could buy a house in Fresno, California for 60 grand. Seriously?
My record is 28,000 bucks. It's on a half acre lot in a very nice part of town. It's an older part of town. They call it the Tower District. I bought a house for 28 grand. It's probably worth 325 today.
That's crazy.
Yep.
That's crazy. I mean, when you look at numbers like that, is there ever the temptation to cash out?
No, I live on my cash flow. No, I have a really good life. Wife and I haven't worked in her 8 years, myself almost 5 years, because of our rental cash flow.
Right.
No, I have no interest in turning that off.
Right. Sure. Understood. Yeah. I just, you know, I had to ask the question.
No, of course. It's a great question.
Yeah, absolutely. So what have been some of the things, you know, that maybe staying on the journey a little bit, what have been some things that you have done really right in this business? Obviously, buying right is one of them, but just kind of walk us through maybe some more of the things that you feel like you guys have done right over the years.
Yeah, it's funny. It only hit me in the last 6 months. One of the things that turbocharged our business was the ability to recycle capital. So let me take you back to that first house we bought, Norris Drive. I've talked about it 100 times, 1818 Norris Drive East, 93703, if people want to look it up on Zillow. So I buy it December 11th, 2002 for 107 grand. About 18 months later, I do a cash out refi. So I take out my down payment and I take out about another 30 grand because we walk away with about $50,000. First off, I took out too much money. I didn't realize a bank would allow me to take an asset that was positive cash flow and turn it negative, right? My mortgage payment at the time was something like $1,250 and my rent was $1,100. So it was negative the best months. That was a problem. I call it an alligator. Don't do that. But needless to say, after a year and a half, we got our 20 grand back and we had 30 grand. What we did then, our first recycling capital, is the 30 grand became two more houses. We bought two houses, rough math, for 150K. We put 10% down each. So now we have three houses and we have our 20 grand still, right? Still here. Then, you know, over time, we do a cash out refi again on those properties. Then we do 1031 exchanges, right? Norris Drive is now an alligator. It's negative cash flow. I hate writing that mortgage payment every month because it just irks me. Now we do a 1031 exchange into an apartment building. So we get rid of negative cash flow of about negative 500 and it turns positive 1500. That's a $2,000 swing, monthly cash flow. And we're buying, people, it's hard to say, but multifamily, like commercial, it was five units, so above residential. Nobody was looking at this. This was 04, 05, everybody's hot for houses. So we get into this five unit building for less than we sell the house and the rents more than triple what where the house was. It's gravy upon gravy. And again, those other two houses we bought ultimately go up in value. It becomes a 10 unit and a 13 unit. So that first 20 grand, as we look at it today, because we've recycled it with cash out refis, 1031s, and ultimately sales, has turned into 100 grand in cash, 500 grand in equity, and about 5,000 bucks a month cash flow. When you pay attention, right? I like to talk about buy and hold forever. But I will sell if it's overpriced and I will leverage capital to move stuff around. So yeah, we have recycled capital very powerfully. That's really what got us to turbocharge our business with cash flow.
Right. And you talked about in the downturn, you know, how you guys went out and raised more capital to keep doing deals.
Yeah. When you look at your market every day and you're like, they are selling this house that exists. It's not burned to the ground. Yes, it's messy and there's holes in the walls because people are upset. But, you know, it's a $2,000 fix for less than land value. I was trying to buy everything we could. One of the things I read about the 80s, right, in the SNL crisis, is a lot of the successful investors, they always said near the end of the book, I wish I bought more. Mm. That's what they've always said. And I remember telling Olivia, my wife and better half, Olivia, we are never going to say that. I am going to get uncomfortably close to the edge and we are going to buy everything. So we borrowed against 401ks. We had free and clear cars. We got car notes, everything. We talked about real estate everywhere. We raised millions of dollars from family, friends via private money. And yeah, man, we just went ham.
That's fantastic. I love that. They wish they had bought more. And I wonder, how do you compare that to where we are in today's market cycle? Like, what are you telling people who are looking to just get started?
Well, again, for me, this was introduced to me by Bruce Norris from Norris Group, the affordability index. This works great for residential. It doesn't really work for commercial or multifamily. But basically, there's a ratio that talks about how affordable your MSA or your market is. Mm. And just for reference sake, my source comes from California Association of Realtors, CAR.org. It's a monthly report that comes out and it goes back decades. So for example, Fresno at the peak of the market, which is why I sold, was a 20, right? My California goes from 1 to 100. The lower the number, the least amount of people can afford, right? Mm. So when it gets to 25, it's like my yellow flag. And if it gets to 20, I'm selling everything, right? Because it's unaffordable. Today, Fresno's about a 42. Incomes are up. Rates are ridiculously low. What most people don't realize is I did a 50-year research. I went all the way back to 1970 through 2020. In housing in 2020, it's taken a little hit in 2021, but housing on a income and payment level was never more affordable. It was 16% of the average gross income. So it was affordable in 2020. It's gone up in 2021 because we saw a big hit in the or big jump in the median price, but still it's below trend. It's like 23 or 24%. So housing is affordable today, at least in most markets, not every market, but most markets.
Yeah. And that's a crazy, you know, that's not the words we hear, you know, in the media.
That's because everybody is looking at price. I can't tell you how many channels I talk to that say something like this, Sam. Look at the price in 2020 or 2021. It's above 06. Well, yeah, it's above 06. You've only been looking at real estate 5 years, so you don't have the experience. I bought houses in 06. You know what? Do you remember what the interest rate, a 30-year interest rate was in 06, roughly?
Ooh, 30-year, I'd have put it at maybe 5.5%, 6%.
6.57.
Okay.
6.57. You know what it is today?
3.2.
3.03.
Wow.
So if the price in 2021 is the same as 06, what's your payment like? It's like really low.
Right.
And oh, by the way, your income's up because your income has risen in the last 15 years. So people that are calling housing expensive are simply looking at price and not doing the math. Real estate investing is a game of math. It's not calculus, it's arithmetic, but it's still math and it freaks people out. So housing, unless you're paying cash, it's more affordable today than it was 06 by a long, long shot.
Right, right. Absolutely. On that point of leverage, is there a time in your portfolio in which you intend on being completely unlevered?
Unlevered? Completely, no. I am at 50% LTV today, which is a lot lower than I was. When I was growing and had that six-figure job, I would take it to 80% all day long, every time.
Right.
I never want an alligator. I never want to repeat over refinancing, right? I want each asset to stand alone. I don't want to sit here and say those four pay for this one, right? I want each asset to stand alone. But yeah, as I was growing, I wanted to recycle capital, right? Again, that first house is now 21 doors that we still own, $500,000 and $100,000 in cash. So I did that all the time. But as I got close to the retirement, that last 6 months of working, I'm like, all right, let's have a few free and clear. Let's have a few high leverage. You know, we experienced the last crash. So, you know, hey, if the world ends and all loans go bad, I still have this little pile that will feed us. So we're much less risk averse, but we'll never be unlevered.
Unlevered, right. Yeah, that's interesting. All right. So we talked a little bit about recycling capital. What are some other things you feel like you've done right here in your journey?
Other people may disagree with this, but for me is we never left one market, right? We have bounced around. We went single family, then small multis, then apartments, now commercial, now mixed use. Again, I've never lived in my market. I've still never spent the night in my market. The hardest thing for me to do was build a team. Over the course of time, we have looked at other markets. We've looked at Texas and Vegas and Reno and Denver. And I'm like, God, I don't want to build another team. I personally hate flying and did a million miles for my day job. So I'm like, if I got to get on a plane to see my real estate, I'm not going. Mm. So we never left, which has allowed us to build just an ever-growing network or spider web. 2020 was the hardest year to buy cash flow rentals, even in my market. We added 6 properties, I think it was 9 doors, because of our network. People brought us, they say, Michael buys this. I'm going to call him first. I'm going to double in the commission. I'm like, done, let's go, right? So you don't get that being the new kid on the block, right? Yeah, I stayed loyal to one market.
Yeah, and that's tough. I mean, you sound like you've gone through the shiny object, or we'll call it the shiny market syndrome, where you're like, what about? But you ultimately said no. That's fantastic. Talk to us about One Rental at a Time. What's it been like building that as a brand? Why do you do it? I mean, you put out tons of information on YouTube. I mean, I don't know. I've seen your videos for years. So
yeah, we put out 5 videos a day, 7 days a week. So we put out a fair amount of content.
5 a day?
5 a day is my average. Yeah, we do about 40 videos a week.
Wow. Okay. Talk to us through that. Why so much? How do you come up with the content for it? How have you maintained the discipline to keep doing it? Because that's an insane amount of content.
Yeah. So let's rewind to where One Rental at a Time, the idea came from.
Yeah.
So I just left my W-2 job. I'm 45 years old. The first 2 days you do that, you call everybody in your phone and you tell them you retired or you quit or whatever you want to call it, right? You smile so much, your face hurts. I mean, it's the only time in my life my face physically hurt from smiling. However, because I'm a type A individual, I spend the next 2 to probably 3 weeks getting increasingly depressed. Mm-hmm. It's the only time in my life where I've been close to saying I was depressed. I'm glass half full. I'm hungry. I'm type A. I'm always go, go, go. But when your body wakes you up at 6 a.m. every day, even I haven't had an alarm go off in over a decade, right? It's just not who I am. And I'm up. And, you know, when you do that for 3 or 4 weeks in a row and none of your friends are available, right? Because they're all working. And, you know, your rental properties take like 7 seconds a week to manage. You got nothing to do. So as I'm getting into, let's just call it 3 weeks, I'm literally borderline depressed. I tell my wife on a Friday that if I can't get out of this by the weekend, I'm just going to accept a job because I'm really good at what I do. And I had job offers all over. I'm just going to accept one and go to work Monday, even though we don't need the money. And she's like, okay, because she's seeing me, right? I'm no longer smiling. I'm grumpy, right?
Right.
So then I remember, for whatever reason, I see Rich Dad Poor Dad, which I give credit for in my book for starting our journey. And I'm like, you know what? Rich Dad Poor Dad doesn't tell you how. Nope, I have never seen a story that says, I read Rich Dad Poor Dad, and then here's my journey, and it worked. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go write that. Mm. So I write it. I don't write well. English was like my worst subject in school. Got a, you know, C minus or whatever it is. But I write it, and it's a 15-year journey, a full look back. I feel better, right? I spend 6-8 weeks writing it. I'm engaged. I'm excited. And then I start sharing it. And people say this is something, right? So then I pay for an editor and it becomes the book that it is today. Over 10,000 copies sold as a self-published guy, nearly 1,000 reviews from people. So it did something. So, okay. So that got me out of depression. And then I'm like, you know what? I'm up early enough. I've been reading the financial markets every day for 20 years. Why don't we give this YouTube thing a shot? So then I do what now is called the Daily Financial News, which is a news show I've done 7 days a week, 365 days a year for more than 2 years. That's how this starts, 7:30 every day, right? Except Thursday, sometimes it's 7. As this grows, other people kind of enter my world that I trust, that have experience. So first off, how does the content come out? The Daily Financial News is the first video every day. Then I speak with a multimillionaire. I have 8 multimillionaires that I speak to during the week. Each multimillionaire is 3 videos. We hit 3 topics a day. So that's 4 videos, right? And then when you have the other day, it just spread out the content. And then I do a daily live Q&A most Saturdays. And then I just switch. And then the other step is I do a hot take like the eviction moratorium or CDC this or rent increases. I just did a live stream about the top 10 most unaffordable markets. And I'm still doing this business. I do walkthroughs and deals I'm doing. So it's actually pretty easy. But yeah, my superpower is discipline, right? So I look forward to doing the daily show. Most people that do it, you know, almost 800 days in a row would be bored with it. I'm like, I can't wait to do tomorrow. Yeah, I'm excited. So I still have fun every day. That's how.
Man, that's fantastic. And then how do you maintain that discipline? I mean, surely you're not always home in your studio ready to record.
Yeah. So one thing that will not fail is I will do the daily show every day. So we've done trips to Taiwan. I figure out what is 7:30 wherever I'm at. And if I have to, I'll record it, right? Usually I do it live. That's my preference. But if I'm somewhere with bad Wi-Fi or something, I will record it, upload it, and schedule. So that is the video you can count on. A couple of times I've taken really long vacations, I'll seed videos like, hey, I'll do four topics with my guests and I'll do two this week and two next week. I just pre-plan it. And we've had life events, all of that. You can count on the daily show. I will find a way to get that done. There have been days where I do one video, not many, but there have been some days.
Right, right. That's super cool. I mean, and what has been the benefit and why do you keep doing it other than just the fact that you enjoy it?
The impact, right? So this contest over my left shoulder, which you probably have seen us talk about, this contest 500.
I've not seen it. Tell us about it.
I have this positive impact score that I talk about every Sunday. I basically, all my time, what is it producing? So I did an audit on May 31st of 2021. I'm like, because it's every 3 months I audit what's going on. And I asked myself, how many deals have people done because of one rental at a time? The book, the channel, the course, whatever. And near as I can tell, I think we did 187 in 18 months. That was kind of cool, but honestly, I was disappointed.
Right.
That's like 10 a month, Zuber. That sucks. You're better than that. And what I told myself was, is you weren't asking people to tell you. So I'm like, done. I went on, I don't know, whatever site that is, you order cards and business cards. And I got these things. It says 500. Congratulations, being one of 500. You did it. I'm so happy for you. How to get started one rental at a time. So now what I tell people every day is if one rental at a time helped you at all, and you close your first or next rental property, tell me about it and I will mail you one of these. I'm trying to get to 500 in a year. And oh, by the way, because I know the audience is going to crush it, I bought 1,500 of these. I plan to send out 1,500. And then, oh, by the way, if we do 500, I'm going to do some crazy things. Well, it looks like we're going to donate 10 grand to a food bank in Fresno, because as I grew up, food insecurity was a big deal. So we are going to cover one full day of food in Fresno County. I had the county president tell me it's $9,837. So we're going to send a 10K check. I'm going to dye my hair purple. You can see a lot of my stuff is purple. And a crazy one also is my mom, who is deathly afraid of the internet and camera shy, has also agreed, because she wants to do this. She will let me interview her and ask questions for my audience. So we get to embarrass myself with stories of my childhood. So if I help you, tell me about this, because after 15 weeks, we're like at about 180. So we're definitely on path to do this. So I want to see what happens, man. Let's just go ham and help people do some cool stuff.
Man, I love that. Yeah, that's a lot of fun. Clearly, you bring a lot of energy and commitment, obviously, to what it is, you know, that you guys are doing. What have been some challenges maybe that you guys have faced, you know, maybe on the growing side of things?
Well, there's all kinds of challenges. One thing you have to realize is real estate's a people business. And because it's a people business, people are going to disappoint you. Perhaps the greatest story of perseverance actually is our first rental property, right? So think about this. We spend a year in the Bay Area realizing that nothing cash flows in the Bay Area. This is 2002. Then we have a come to Jesus meeting around our kitchen table. And she goes, I'm not doing this anymore. 52 Sundays in a row were ruined because you're driving me in a car looking at housing. Stop the madness. So we ultimately find Fresno. We hit Fresno like 3 or 4 weeks later, which is a 2.5 hour drive and a 2.5 hour drive back. And we do that, we see one house available because the market's going up at this point.
Right.
But it hits the numbers. But I feel like I need to see more. So on the way back, we're on a road called 152. It's the highway back. Olivia says, pull over. I go, I'm thinking she has to use the restroom or make a phone call or whatever. She goes, why didn't you write an offer? I'm like, honey, we only saw one house. I don't know Fresno from like LA, right? I've never lived there. She goes, did it hit our numbers? Yeah, it hit our numbers. She asked me again, why didn't you write an offer? And she goes, if you don't write an offer on that, I'm never coming back. I'm like, oh, let me call the agent. I'll write an offer right now. So, okay, we write the offer. We get the property. We're super excited. We celebrate. We get a tenant in. Everything is roses. And then the tenant gets divorced or separated. The wife takes off 2 weeks after moving in, never to be heard from again. The husband is not happy. He decides to stop working and become a professional alcoholic. He never makes another rent payment. This is our first house. You live in California. it takes us 3 months to get them out.
And that's probably quick for today's standard.
Oh, yeah, that's quick for today. Yeah, this is 2002 or now 2003. So we get them out after 90 days, which means 4 missed rent payments. And we walk in and the house is wrecked.
Yeah.
15 grand later, we start over. Again, I get back to the car and I'm expecting Olivia to say, sell this thing, get out of here. What are you doing? Fresno sucks. I don't know what she was going to say, but she's like, did we do anything wrong? I'm like, no, credit check, reference check. There's no box on any rental application that ever says, are you going to get divorced?
And are you going to become an alcoholic?
Like, yeah, exactly. It just doesn't exist, right? So no. And she goes, okay, keep going. We're going to try it again. And then again, Norris Drive is great. It goes on to double in value. The next tenant never misses a payment. But again, that first story probably would have wrecked most people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And commitment to the vision. Sounds like your wife had it maybe.
Yeah. That's one thing I tell people, get on board 100% with your significant other. 99% is not enough. Because if she was only 99% on board, all I would have heard is, I told you so, I told you so, I told you so.
Mm-hmm.
But because she was on board and saw the bigger vision, she's like, did we do anything wrong? No. Okay, go.
That's awesome. I love that. I love that. And there's unpredictable things in this business that will occur. So being prepared for those is key. Hey, I've really enjoyed this, Michael. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience before we jump here into the final 4 questions?
I just want people to believe that buy and hold real estate is certainly get rich slow, but it is a get rich for sure. And it's worth the effort.
That's great. That's a good word. I like that. Here we go. And you may have already answered this question, but we'll do it anyway. If I gave you just 20 grand to invest in real estate with no previous real estate investing experience, what would you do with it and why?
Oh, I would probably take half of that, make it my emergency fund. Because again, one thing I've seen is surprises happen. It's so funny how they often happen in threes. So first off, half of that would become my emergency fund, not to be touched. And the other 10 grand would likely become my seed capital for my first purchase. Yeah, that's what I would do with it.
Awesome. Love that. Question number 2, if you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Excel spreadsheets lie. I can't tell you how many people tell me all the time, I'm going to invest out of state in this market that I've never been to because the yield or cash on cash or cash flow is high. I don't know about you, but I just got to tell you that real life typically doesn't match the spreadsheet. Do the math, do the work, spreadsheets lie.
Right. That's, yeah, absolutely true. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
I am trying to give back each and every day. I'm bringing other experts because I know there's only certain topics I can discuss in detail. So I look for others that bring skills that I don't have.
That's fantastic. Last question. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
I would go to your Google search bar, type in rental at a time. You should see a YouTube channel, Instagram, book, website. I shouldn't be hard to find at this point.
Awesome. Michael, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, buddy.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.